G'day, I'm Gary Stevens, and welcome to the second series of the History in the Bible podcast. More of the history in more of the books in all the Bibles. Episode 2.25, The Quest for the Historical Jesus. In the last episode, I related how modern scholars have assembled what they believe to be a reliable Greek text of the New Testament. On to the final half of my final season, the history in the New Testament. Over the course of the past 150 years, New Testament scholarship has not been a relentless march to a greater certainty. New Testament scholarship has weathered four great intellectual tsunamis, each obliterating the older. Is the current wave the last? Who knows? As I said in my very first episode, 1.1, all the history in all the books in all the Bibles, I do not pretend for a minute to be objective. I will follow the approaches of two schools of modern thought. The first is called the Third Quest for the Historical Jesus. The second is the New Perspectives approach on Paul. Both debuted in the 1970s and are still going strong today. I'll work through the birth, infancy, mission, death, and resurrection of Jesus, as depicted in each of the Gospels. I'll also investigate what the book of Acts and the letters of Paul have to tell us of the earliest Christians. And there I will end my podcast. Of course, at the heart of my story is the figure of Jesus. What did Jesus believe about himself? Who did others think he was? How does Jesus fit into his Jewish milieu? What do the Gospels tell us about his birth, life, and death? Jesus' life story is supported by an ensemble of A-list players. His parents, Joseph and Mary, John the Baptist, James the Just, Peter the Rock, and the mysterious other disciples, Mary Magdalene and Paul the Apostate. In supporting roles are the Roman governors, the last remaining Herodian kings, the Greeks, the people of Galilee and Judea, and the faction of the Pharisees. Every book in the New Testament has its own agenda. In this final part of my series, my job is to deconstruct those agendas and reassemble them into the best possible story that modern scholarship can offer us. Here is one thing I am not going to do: debate the theological status of Jesus. How you regard Jesus is a matter for yourself. I am interested only in the Jesus of history and what historians can discover about this person from the sources we have to hand. The ancient story of Christianity, as it was told by the church, was straightforward. The earliest Christians created a wholly new religion based on the deeds and sayings of Jesus, an historically unique figure. The disciples, led by Peter, worked with James, the brother of Jesus, and Paul the convert, to spread the word throughout the empire. The letters written by Paul, Peter, John, and other apostolic figures all demonstrated their commitment to Jesus and to the common goal. Their unified message was soon corrupted by heretics, against whom the church waged perpetual war. The Christian communities were derided by the Jews and persecuted by the Roman state. No one had any doubt that the authors of the Gospels and the letters were those hallowed by tradition, and that these books were written soon after the death of Jesus. The Gospels presented a harmonious and reliable biography of Jesus. The book of Acts did the same for Peter and Paul. That story was first challenged by the German polymath Hermann Samuel Reimarus. Today he is called the founder of the first quest for the historical Jesus. Reimarus was the first to distinguish between the Christ portrayed by the Church and the historical Jesus. Reimarus was an Enlightenment contemporary of Voltaire. He lived in an age of religious scepticism and at the heyday of deism. Deism held that while we could use reason to deduce the existence of God, the organized religions of the world had nothing to say about him. God was the great clockmaker who maintained the mechanism of the world, but who never tried to repurpose the great chronometer. Benjamin Franklin, a younger contemporary of Reimarus, was one of America's most noted deists. Reimarus was part of a scholarly family. I mentioned his father-in-law, Johann Fabricius, in episode 2.8, Lost Books of the New Testaments. Fabricius was the first to assemble a collection of the vast parabiblical literature, those books that almost made it into the Bible. Reimarus' investigations into the historical Jesus were published anonymously, 10 years after his death, at the height of the American War of Independence. Like all deists, he rejected miracles. He held that the contradictions between the different gospel accounts rendered them untrustworthy witnesses. To Reimarus, Jesus was a Jewish reformer who became increasingly fanatical. He was a failed revolutionary. His duped disciples invented stories of a resurrection and an imminent return, stories they knew to be fabricated. You can see why Reimarus preferred to be dead when his work was published. Among the faithful, his book was an outrageous blasphemy. His fellow deists thought he was unnecessarily provocative. Reimarus never took a really long, hard look at the Gospels. In Napoleonic times, other German scholars pointed out what now seems obvious. The Gospel of John is a work of theology, not biography. Of the four Gospels, the Gospel of John is the odd man out. John reads nothing like the other Gospels. It has a very different chronology for the life of Jesus. To take the best known example, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus' cleansing of the temple in the last week of his life is the event that galvanizes the Jewish authorities against him and sends him to his death. In John, the cleansing is one of Jesus' first acts. The truly towering figure of this first phase of modern scholarship was Ferdinand Christian Bauer. He is invariably known just as F.C. Bauer. Bauer was a professor at the University of Tübingen during the High Victorian period. Bauer produced one book every year for 40 years, and not one of them was crackpot. F.C. Bauer constructed the entire framework of modern New Testament studies. Whether they agree with him or not, all modern scholars have to grapple with the arguments that Bauer made 160 years ago. Bauer argued that earliest Christianity was not a beautiful harmony of personalities and beliefs. Two factions were engaged in civil war. One was led by the disciple Peter and James, the brother of Jesus. They saw Jesus as the one come to save the Jews. To be saved, they said, you first had to become a Jew and follow the Torah, the law. The other party was led by Paul. He argued at length that anyone could be saved, and they certainly did not have to follow the Torah. This was the central conflict at the heart of earliest Christianity. Bauer showed how most books in the New Testament were on one side or the other. The Gospel of Matthew, the letter of James, and Revelation were pro-Torah. Paul's letters and the Gospel of Mark were anti-Torah. The later books of the New Testament tried to reconcile the two as presenting a united front. The book of Acts depicts Paul and Peter in agreement. In Acts, Peter sounds more like Paul than the Peter of the Gospels. And Paul sounds more like Peter than the Paul of the letters. The last of Paul's letters, to Timothy and Titus, contain thoughts that Paul repudiated in his early letters. But these notions would have been amenable to Peter's faction. The church also added some brief letters, supposedly written by Peter, which depict Peter as sympathetic to Paul's faction. Bauer's big ideas will be a constant thread in future episodes. Through the end of the 19th century, critics increasingly turned their forensic skills on the New Testament books. Paul's letters were especially put under the blowtorch. By 1900, few scholars believed that the letters to Timothy and to Titus and to the Hebrews were actually written by Paul. Paul's authorship of the letters to the Colossians, Ephesians, and 2 Thessalonians fell under a cloud that has never been lifted. The 19th century was spent questing for the historical Jesus, trying to disentangle the life of Jesus from the theology and the later accretions of the church. In the opening decades of the 20th century, a new wave said that all their work was futile and irrelevant. Two legendary Lutheran scholars stand out: the French-German polymath Albert Schweitzer and the German professor Rudolf Bultmann. For 60 years until his death in 1965, Albert Schweitzer was one of the world's most renowned and beloved intellectuals and humanitarians. David Attenborough, eat your heart out. He wrote two of the most influential books on Jesus ever penned. The English translator of his first book invented the term Quest for the Historical Jesus. Schweitzer argued that his predecessors simply constructed an historical Jesus who fitted into their preconceptions. Schweitzer also argued that presentations of Jesus had neglected his apocalyptic message. Jesus believed in the imminent coming of the final judgment and God's kingly rule. Jesus urged his followers to forsake their possessions, turn away from their families, and not even respond to their enemies. The end was soon, any week now. There was no future to worry about or provide for. Jesus' cry of dereliction on the cross was his despairing acceptance that the end of times had not arrived and his God had failed him. Schweitzer eventually decided that the search for a historical Jesus was futile. He abandoned biblical scholarship and spent much of the rest of his life in Africa as a medical missionary. Rudolf Bultmann was a towering figure of early 20th century scholarship. I cannot make head nor tail of him. Insofar as I can understand a single word he wrote, he follows Schweitzer in abandoning the historical Jesus. Bultmann argued that the historical analysis of the New Testament was pointless and unnecessary. The historical facts of the life of Jesus meant nothing to the disciples and Paul, and should mean nothing to us today. Christianity starts with the death of Jesus, not with his life. Bultmann argued we can only talk of the thatness, not the whatness of Jesus. Only that Jesus existed, not what Jesus did in his life. Everything important about Jesus happened after he died. Maybe it reads better in the original German. In the first third of the 20th century, Schweitzer and Bultmann had very firmly stomped on the heads of any professors who wanted to construct a biography of Jesus. Biblical academics only put their heads above the parapets when Schweitzer and Bultmann were old men. After the Second World War, professors began a second quest for the historical Jesus. As it had been for a century, study was led by those trained in German universities. Challenging Schweitzer and Bultmann, the second questers asserted that it was indeed possible to construct a biography from the Gospels. We only need tools to analyze the Gospels in a systematic manner. The questers started from a baseline. To find the authentic, historical Jesus, they said, we must exclude everything in the Gospels that can be found in the Judaism of the time, and we must exclude everything found in later Christianity. And so we can precisely delineate the life and sayings of Jesus. The most influential scholar of the Second Quest period was the German professor Walter Bauer, no relation to F.C. Bauer. He reinterpreted the entire history of the Church as it had been presented by Christians from earliest times. The Church Fathers follow a single, unremitting line. Orthodoxy was right belief, the true message of Jesus. Heresy was deviation from right belief. Right belief preceded heresy. The true message of Jesus was corrupted by villains who wished to pervert the purity of the original message. The Church Fathers fought relentlessly to preserve the original, pristine orthodoxy against later wicked heresy. Check out the 2nd century father Irenaeus, the great hammer of the heretics, whom I discussed in episode 2.22, Battle for the New Testament 2, against Marcion. Walter Bauer contended all that was garbage. He argued that the early church did not comprise a pure orthodoxy that developed cancerous heresies. As far back as we can trace our sources, he said, right from the time of Jesus, Christianity was a warring community of factions and beliefs. The eventual winner rewrote the history of the conflict to portray itself as the one true religion, and all its competitors as evil. Towards the end of his life, Bauer's ideas were spectacularly vindicated in the 1940s by the discovery of the Nag Hammadi manuscripts. I covered those finds in episode 2.18, Modern Debates, Scandal of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Nag Hammadi documents show that Christians drew sustenance from a lush forest of diverse works and beliefs, all of which were later suppressed. Walter Bauer showed that concepts of orthodoxy and heresy were meaningless. Heresy was just a label that the winners attached to the losers. The second questers constructed tools to analyze passages in the Gospels. One is the criterion of difference. A passage in the Gospels or letters is likely to be authentic if it shows Jesus as rejecting contemporary Jewish doctrine. The second questers compared Jesus' sayings and practices against the rabbinic literature, especially the Mishnah, the Jewish law digest of the High Roman Empire. Any saying or practice that differs from the Mishnah is likely authentic. The criterion of difference also holds as authentic a gospel passage that grates against later Christian writers or goes against the natural inclinations of the gospel author. A good example is the sign nailed to Jesus' cross, reading King of the Jews. All the Gospels mention that sign, but no later Christian does. None of the Church Fathers call Jesus King of the Jews. The second questers held that this was very good grounds to assert that the Gospel writers had recorded a real historical fact about the death of Jesus, a fact that later embarrassed the church. Another example is Jesus' sayings on divorce. Here is the Gospel of Mark. Quote, Mark 10:2. Some Pharisees came, and to test him they asked, Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? He answered them, What did Moses command you? They said, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of dismissal and to divorce her. But Jesus said to them, But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. End quote. Judaism had no problem with divorce. The criterion of difference holds that we can safely regard this as an authentic saying of Jesus, since Jesus disagrees with the Jews. But now listen to what Matthew says. Quote, Matthew 5:31. It was also said, Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. End quote. Matthew gives people an out. He knows people get divorced. Matthew wants to soften Jesus' hardline stance. He also puts the culpability firmly on men who divorce. The women are blameless victims. Now here is Luke's version. Quote, Luke 16:18. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. End quote. Luke ameliorates Mark in a different way. To Luke, the problem is not divorce, but remarriage. That is the big no-no. Now let's hear Paul, who has his own take. This passage is one of only three times that Paul cites the authority of Jesus. Quote, 1 Corinthians 7:10. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does separate, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. End quote. Paul acknowledges that people divorce. But if you must divorce, then here is what you should do. Matthew, Luke, and Paul all know that Jesus prohibited divorce. They aren't happy about that. It just doesn't fit in with their own ideas. They really don't want to accept Mark's version of Jesus. The criterion of difference argues that is a good reason to believe that Mark is the reliable source, and Jesus entirely forbade divorce. The divorce sayings are a great example of another analytical tool, the criterion of multiple attestation. The more independent sources who attest to a saying or event, the more likely it is to be true. The trick is in working out the relationships between our sources. Matthew and Luke use a lot of Mark. We can't say Matthew and Luke are independent if all they are doing is citing Mark. I'll have a lot more to say about that real soon now. Another tool is the criterion of embarrassment. Any gospel story that would have embarrassed the early church is likely authentic. The entire crucifixion is an excellent example. crucifixion was a death meted out to traitors. No one would want to say that their founder was a traitor. So under this criterion, the crucifixion is held to be a reliable story. Or take this example, where Jesus distinguishes himself from God. Quote, Mark 10:17. As he was setting out on a journey, a man ran up and knelt before him and asked him, Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus said to him, Why do you call me good? No one is good but God alone. End quote. That would have struck the earliest Christians as incomprehensible. They all believed that in some sense Jesus was God. But here Jesus seems to be denying that relationship. Under the criterion of embarrassment, this is likely something Jesus actually said. The whole basis of the second quest was undermined in the 1970s by yet another wave of scholars. I'll just mention three of the leading lights for your later reference. As of this podcast, all are alive and thriving. Why not look them up? The first is Nicholas Thomas Wright, always known as N.T. Wright or Tom Wright. Tom Wright is a retired Anglican bishop and now a professor at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. The second is Ed Parish Sanders, a Texan born and bred, and now a professor at Duke University. Of course, he is only ever called E.P. Sanders. Third up is James D.G. Dunn, another British professor. What is it with this fetish for initials? Now, there are some weird coincidences here. N.T. Wright was Bishop of Durham in England. James D.G. Dunn was a professor at Durham University in England. E.P. Sanders was a professor at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Lots of Durhams here. The professors of the second search for the historical Jesus allowed their endeavours to be labelled the new quest for Jesus, but they were not impressed by the appellation. The new wave explicitly say they are undertaking the third quest for the historical Jesus. The scholars of the second quest were European Protestant theologians. In the third quest, the historical Jesus is the subject of study by a gaggle of international scholars from many disciplines and faiths. This is a worldwide intellectual endeavour, not just a European one. The third quest is also the first to mine books outside the canon, such as the Gospel of Thomas and the works found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Previous generations had pooh-poohed any source outside the New Testament. The third quest scholars embrace every papyrus find. If you feel inclined, why not listen to my episode 2.17, Recovering the Bible, A Century of Revelations, for more on that topic. The third quest rejects the central dogma of the second quest. The second quest held that the truth about the historical Jesus was to be had by ignoring everything in the Gospels that tied Jesus to Judaism and to later beliefs such as Gnosticism. Scholars of the third quest hold that is precisely the wrong assumption to make. To the contrary, Jesus can only be understood by placing him into his Jewish context. Before the third quest, the Jewishness of Jesus was a real matter of dispute. Throughout the entire history of the Christian Church, Jesus' Jewish identity has been downplayed, if not denied. Today, no one sees Jesus' Jewishness as contentious. Jesus was a Jew, and any evaluation of his words, deeds, and fate must keep that in mind. Third Quest scholars hold he was brought up in Jewish culture and accepted Jewish ways. Unless you can demonstrate otherwise from the Gospels, you have to accept that Jesus was an observant Jew. But what kind of Jew was he? Some depict him as a violent revolutionary, others as a Gandhi, leading a pacifist renewal movement. Jewish scholars often interpret him as a Pharisee or an Essene. Yet others see in him an apocalyptic prophet, or the exact opposite, a wandering sage like the Greek cynics. Like the scholars of the Second Quest, those of the Third Quest have their own analytical tools to assess the trustworthiness of the gospel accounts of the life of Jesus. I earlier mentioned the criteria of difference, embarrassment, and multiple attestation. The Third Quest scholars reject the criterion of difference, the idea that a gospel passage is likely to be authentic if it shows Jesus as rejecting contemporary Jewish practices. The Third Questers want to show how connected Jesus is to Judaism, not how different. The Second Questers had relied on the Mishnah as a historical compendium of Jewish practice. Modern Jewish scholars have shown that the rabbinic texts are inconsistent, where one document may say that Rabbi A, who lived in time X, first opined about such and such. Another document attributes the same opinion to Rabbi B, who lived generations later. We cannot really pin down the beliefs and practices of the Jews of Jesus' time. If we don't know what mainstream Jews of the time thought, how can we judge how Jesus differed from them? Out the window with the criterion of difference. The analytical tool that the Second Quest scholars took as fundamental was shown to be worthless. Most Third Quest scholars are also skeptical of the criterion of embarrassment. It just seems too vague. Quite a number of other tools have been considered in the past years since the Third Quest gathered momentum. Some have proposed a criterion of historical plausibility. The key, these scholars say, is this: whatever is attributed to Jesus must locate him as a first century Judean. Now comes the important part. It must also explain later developments in the primitive Jesus clubs. Here's an example. In this passage from Mark, Jesus rejects Jewish dietary laws. Quote, Mark 7:14. Then he called the crowd again and said to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile." End quote. "Eat all the prawns and bacon you want," says Mark's Jesus. Forget the diet. But if Jesus really said that, then passages in Acts and Paul's letter to the Galatians make no sense. In these accounts, Peter and James insist that Jesus' fans must follow Jewish dietary practices. The criterion of historical plausibility holds that Mark is unreliable. Jesus never said his fans could avoid kosher. There are lots of other suggestions for analytical tools and criteria. One notion is that a story attested to by both friends and foes of the Christians is likely authentic. For example, Christians hold that Jesus was not the son of Joseph. A few pagan writers and the later Jewish Talmuds agree. They say Jesus was the son of a Roman soldier. Both friendly and hostile sources aver that Joseph was not the biological father of Jesus. So there is a nugget they hold in common, and therefore likely authentic. I have no idea how to evaluate all these tools and criteria that eminent professors have devised. They argue furiously with themselves, so I'm certainly not going to stick my oar in. In the next episode of The History in the Bible, I present the very earliest witness to Christianity. Thanks for listening. For maps, charts, and diagrams, check out my website, www.historyinthebible.com.